This podcast is in no way affiliated with the Stars production or Diana Gabaldon. All views expressed are solely our own. Welcome to the Outlander podcast,
where the men are kilted, the women are winsome,
and the whiskey is neat. Welcome to episode 350. I'm Ginger.
And I'm Summer, and we are in love with all things Outlander.
This episode, our read-along of the chapter of A Breath of Snow and Ashes, is pre-recorded, but as Summer is recovering from surgery earlier this week, I'm going to do this little wee intro solo. She is well, and she will be back for the intro next week. This week, we'd like to thank co-producer Laura D., and stay tuned to the very end of the show. We will let you know a little bit more about what a co-producer is and how you can find out more.
And now, on to our read-along! This week, we are continuing our A Breath of Snow and Ashes read-along with Chapter 15, entitled Stick It to Droon.
Roger has arrived at River Run. If you remember, it's been a hot minute or so. Roger had been tasked by Jaime before he left to go to the people of the Snowbird, right? That Cherokee tribe, or a number of Cherokee villages, groups, to begin his first official going out as an Indian agent. He tasked Roger with going to, with others, not by himself, to go help pick up the, I think it's, well, it's
the new
now
tenants.
In this chapter, we learn it's 76. Yeah, the new tenants. We learned it's 76 people. But at that point, I don't think he had a number. But it was a go pick up the Protestant tenants, and we need you because you're a Protestant. I mean, and it also gives you something to do. And he took Jem along. So that took, that left Bree with her mom and others on the ridge. Roger has arrived at River Run on his journey to collect the new Protestant settlers. The next morning, here they are. They've collected them. They're all camping out in the meadow, and this is the night before they all take off to leave for the ridge. So the next morning, they would leave for the ridge.
I didn't get that at first.
Whether they were camping?
No, I knew that they were there. I knew that he'd collected them. In my brain, I thought that because he was describing all of the things there, that they were getting ready to leave. So then when he sat down and got faced with Duncan Innes, I was very confused. I mean, I know he's not driving. He's riding a horse. But I don't think...
It's that damn Hiram... It's Hiram Crombie. He just can't take him.
Just saying.
So there are 22 families made up of 76 people, 4 mules, 2 ponies, 14 dogs, 3 pigs, some chickens, some kittens, and pet birds, I thought. I mean... Like, the birds were, it all kind of, not all of it, a lot of it made a lot of sense because of animals, but ooh.
There were so many kittens that no one counted them.
And chickens.
Like, there were too many. There's like, there are kittens. I don't have time to count all of those kittens.
And after this, he needed a drink. So the chapter opens with him sitting on the terrace with Duncan Innes imbibing. Lorraine B. writes, right off the bat, the title of this chapter comes up in a conversation Roger has with Duncan Innes. Roger likens the new tenants to Covenanters, who are pious Presbyterian Scots of intense faith who didn't look favorably upon pleasures like drinking alcohol to relax or have fun. Roger describes the people as, quote, fish out of water. Now, it's not referenced in this chapter unless I skimmed past it or didn't, just missed it. But in previous chapters, when in the chapter where Jaime is asking him to go do this, he mentions, I believe he mentions that these people are so, it's not just giving people a place to live, right? And, you know, obviously they need clothing, not weapons, tools to do the land. It's not just rehoming these people. These people are clueless. And I don't mean they're stupid. I mean, they're clueless. They're not farmers. They're fisher folk. They live on on the sea or on the coast. So when that is, when your ancestry is based off of living off the water, living off the sea, you're not a farmer. So it's not just the fact that these people are newly in from Scotland. So there's culture shock. There's new place shock. Like they've had to leave their homes. They also now have to begin, once they get to the ridge and start settling in, they have to begin a brand new way of life. So it's a lot. It's a lot. And that's why so anyway, my point with saying that, with reminding us all of that, is that when Roger says they're fish out of water, I thought, that's too true. Not only are they metaphorically fish out of water, they're on the level of they're not in the place that they're used to be. They're clueless. They also, you know, fish water. They used to live and work by the sea. So it was kind of a cute little, almost a pun, but I don't believe it was intended, because it was not referenced chapter that they kind of, yeah. It was not referenced in this chapter, at least. I don't believe that they were, that in Scotland, they're from the area near the coast, or an area near part of the coast. Everyone seems terrified because, not just because of all the stuff I just said, but what makes it even worse, you know, they're being taken into the jaws of hell. They're going to live with papists.
Right.
Roger says they don't drink much. And Roger says mostly if they do, it's only if they're in danger of death. So it's not that they never drink, but they definitely don't do it to party, to relax. It's not a regular thing. It's not part of their life or lifestyle. We are introduced to the character of Hiram Crombie. I don't think we meet him, but he's mentioned here. He's the supposed leader of the new Protestant ridge dwellers. And they have a chat, Duncan and Roger, about Covenanters and how Duncan's grandsire was one.
You call them ridge dwellers, and that sounded to me like you were calling them goblins. You're like the ridge dwellers.
Okay, we have to call them the goblins from now on.
I'm just saying.
Okay, I was gonna name this episode because of the ending. I was gonna call it Who's Your Daddy, because I think that's funny. But I think goblins is, I mean, not saying goblins is fun. Would you say you'd like ridge goblins or just goblins?
Ridge goblins, just because you said it in such ridge a way goblins. That it sounded like they were dirty, filthy, living of the ground.
Oh, Lord.
Probably in caves. Like, I was imagining Gollum.
The
ridge
dwellers. Gollum lived partly in the water. They have a chat about Covenanters and how Duncan's grandsire was one. So from the article on Wikipedia about Covenanters. Quote, Covenanters is the term generally used for the 17th century Scottish religious and political movement. In general, supporters advocated a Presbyterian Church of Scotland, or Kirk, and the primacy of religious leaders over the monarchy. The name derived from the word covenant, which referred to a bond or agreement with God, with particular reference to the 1638 Scottish National I copied and pasted, so I think it's a typo. Covenant, and the 1643 Solemn League and Covenant. The move originated in religious disputes with James VI and his son Charles I of England, which resulted in the 1639 and 1640 Bishops' Wars. The Covenanters took control of government, but their support for Charles I in the 1648 Second English Civil War, when Charles II in 1651, Third English Civil War, led to Scotland's incorporation into the Commonwealth of England. So there's so much about Scottish history, obviously, that, you know, that is touched upon in these books that leads us to, like, their obviously current state today as far as being at that point, a Commonwealth, not quite a United Kingdom, I don't think. Although I could be wrong. So after the 1660 restoration, they lost control of the Kirk and became a persecuted minority, leading to several armed rebellions and a period from 1679 to 1688 known as the Killing Time. After the 1688 Glorious Revolution in Scotland, the Kirk readopted a Presbyterian structure. This is generally taken as marking the end of the mainstream Covenanter movement, although dissident minorities persisted in Scotland, Ireland, and North America. So, of that group was Duncan's grandsire. And we learned that Duncan's grandsire's sister, so his great uncle, I guess, was executed by drowning. And I thought, huh, that may come up again. We know someone else who, at least in the show, was executed by drowning.
Was staked to droon.
Exactly. And I will say, and this is one of those things, it's not necessarily as bad. It's still, well, one was not a death, this was a death. But one was an attempted execution, obviously. Just like we didn't want to go through, and I didn't want to go through, and talk about details of the Roderick hanging. I didn't write down any details of what they described from the, it wasn't necessarily graphic, but it was very disturbing how they described how she died. But the description of deaths by drowning are absolutely horrible. Absolutely horrible. Lorraine B. writes, "When his grandfather and his brother hid after the Battle of Dunbar, their sister was taken by the English troops and tied to a stake at the tide line in hopes she would give up their location. When she didn't, she drowned when the tide came in." And Lorraine B. also shared a link about the Battle of Dunbar in 1650 from Wikipedia, and I'll put that. I'll put all these links in the show notes. And then she also shared another link to a site that describes the Covenant or Covenanters. Back to the chapter proper. We get a little lesson on predestination, or maybe a big lesson, from Diana through Duncan and throughout this chapter. Quote, "They'd say 'twas none of her doing at all." This is in response to his great aunt being chosen for persecution because she was God's chosen and would go to heaven and that kind of thing. Duncan says, "They'd say 'twas none of her doing at all. God chose her for salvation and chose the English to be damned," unquote. He goes on to quote, "By the decree of God for his everlasting glory, some men and angels are predestined unto everlasting life and others foreordained to everlasting death," unquote. And this Roger recognized from the Westminster Confession. Roger lets us know, or Diana does through Roger, that Presbyterians of his own time, so at least in the 60s, late 60s, still held predestination as a doctrine, but, quote, "a bit more flexible in attitude. They tended to soft pedal the notion of predestined damnation and not to think too much on the idea that every detail of life was so predestined," unquote. As for himself, he didn't know. Duncan says he thinks he does not believe in that. And we get, this is actually a very interesting chapter. It's about bringing people to a new home, but you learn about, different parts of religion. You learn, and now we're going back to Ardsmuir. I mean, seriously, the books jump all over the freaking place. So Duncan shares with Roger more about their time in Ardsmuir. There were loads, and it is related to the Protestant Catholic divide. There was loads of fight between the Catholics and the Protestants there, and so much so that he said that although they both were, I'm sure, cantankerous, at least that's what I gleaned from reading, the Protestants who had, so Tom Christie and his group, basically, he was basically their leader, quote unquote, in Ardsmuir. The Protestants who enjoyed every time they got a chance to tell the Catholics that they were damned, basically, and tons of fights. So remember. In a little bit, although we haven't had him a lot yet, we'll learn a little bit more later. So this is kind of telegraphing. How did Jamie, who even when though Tom Christie was kind of like the low key leader of the Protestants there, how did Jamie was still the dude? I mean, he was the dude there at Ardsmuir. How did McDough put a stop to it? He made them all Freemasons. They were going to have supper, this is Roger and Duncan, with both Tom Christie and Hiram Crombie. So they get to drinking. They're like, nope, we got to pregame it now. Lorraine B. writes, "It's quite the horrific story and interesting to see Roger and Duncan discuss predestination as a way for Duncan's grandfather to absolve himself of any blame in her death, her being, that would have been his sister, so Duncan's great aunt. This leads to Duncan describing Tom Christie and his time at Ardsmuir, as Christie is a Presbyterian with a firm belief in predestination, and gives us a better understanding of him. And it leads to Roger questioning his own beliefs and actions." And now we go from religion, new settlers, to religion, to history, to back to Ardsmuir. Now we're getting in the time travel again, folks. I'm telling you, this chapter is all over. Roger sees, quote, "a faint white line through Duncan's upper lip, half visible beneath the hair, and realized suddenly why Duncan wore a long mustache," unquote. He asks Duncan about it. He says he was born with it. Not the line. He was born with a hair lip is a term for it, but it's a
cleft palate.
To what degree, we do not know, because there are degrees of, like, how far the split is. Is it a total split? Is it a split only halfway? Like, there are degrees of split, but it was a cleft palate, a partial cleft palate, at least. And so how did this happen? Who mended it? And he's like, a traveling healer, my mother said. So he definitely gets to thinking. But before we get to Roger's thinking, I thought, a traveling healer indeed, right? So a healer, okay. Traveling, meaning he goes around, right? Like one of those charmers, right? Like the Beatons. Mm-hmm. But traveler, time traveler, ha ha ha. Quote.
Jesus Christ.
Superstar. That was really bad. I chose about 3 keys for that. Quote. "A Highland charmer who could repair a hair lip," unquote. Roger's thinking, oh my gosh, another one. And is it possible? Could there be more like us out there walking around? I mean, I know it's a reflexive, because even though he knows the answer to this, he knows that about Galus. And although Galus, you could link to their kind of family because she is in his lineage. But also it's Ottertooth and the Montauk Five, you know, whom we haven't met, and he doesn't know about him, I don't think. Or maybe he does, but he doesn't say. Here we have Master Raymond. And if you read the Bulges, you know at least about one more. I'm not going to mention it. Please read the Bulges. Anyway, so he knows the answer. This is more of a rhetorical question. He knows the answer is yes, there are others out there. However, what he doesn't mean is, are there others than the people he knows? Because he knows that answer. What he is thinking of, because most of the people outside of Ottertooth and the Montauk Five and that kind of thing are people in his circle, in his family circle, or like Galus in his lineage. So, or I guess, yeah. Well, we don't know. I almost said something. I can't say that too early. Yeah. I'm like, oh, or like someone else that we haven't, whom we haven't had a chance to go around like that with yet. So I can't say it. Anywhoozle, he knows the answer. It would be really silly to think that they were unique. But I think that I think Duncan's story is so, well, the story comes secondary, right? He sees the line first. He sees the scar, which is, once he puts 2 and 4 together, he's like, oh. That doesn't necessarily mean time travel right away, but that's a... And he even tries to justify, he's like, hey, people are doing surgery these days. They do surgery now. But I mean, to what extent and how much and can you do, you know, like, who knows? That's a lot. He'd have to ask Claire, and Claire's not there right now. So the odds of it being someone of the time, and we're talking like what, 40 years earlier, 50 years earlier? How old is Duncan? I don't know, 40 or 50? We're talking of something that didn't happen in that time right then when Claire was there. We're talking about 40 to 50 years earlier when he was an infant. So it's even more unlikely that it was done, you know, by someone of the time. So it makes him think, so how often does this happen? This, you know, time travelers, oot and a boot. And what happens to them? Like, if they're out there, like, do they, obviously they die at some point. Do they fall through stones again? Do they go back home? So it's just kind of rocking his world. He did not expect that after when he sat down to drink, to handle a dinner with 2 potentially, I won't say crazy, because that's a bit stigmatizing. 2 potentially very difficult men to be around. Very particular men. And they're about to have dinner with them. He's like, I just want to get my pregame on and relax, yo. And he didn't expect to have this this type of conversation or this kind of bomb dropped on him. What did you think about that during this, your second reading of about the Snow and Ashes?
About the potential. I didn't remember the hair lip conversation at all.
Oh, okay.
So I was like, I kind of like it when they throw in these ideas that they could be everywhere. You don't know. Why is she special?
Dude, completely. Lorraine B. writes, now we have another mystery to solve now that we know Otter Tooth's backstory. And I wonder, Lorraine, if you meant Duncan's. But she goes on to say, I really enjoy this fantasy side of Outlander. I've never come across another book series that does this. DG just drops these little bombs with no apparent warning, and I find it so delightful. That is exactly the word that I use. She just dropped the bomb on.
It's not only that, to be honest, it's not only that. It's that Diana Gabaldon writes these stories that are at their heart and soul about eight people. So that's a lot of people to keep track of. Just calm down. I'm not done yet.
You're funny, Summer.
I'm not done yet.
No, but that was funny.
But you don't know yet. You don't even know what I was going to say.
Oh, Lord.
My point is that...
It doesn't matter. It's already funny.
Okay, fine. So she writes these books and has these detailed plot lines about these eight people. These eight main people, right? By the book eight. So that's difficult enough all by itself.
No. Eight storylines. But it's not eight characters, eight storylines.
The main storylines and those people that are involved in those are enough. That's a lot to keep track of and a lot to research and a lot to come up with. Every single character she comes in, any of these other main characters come into contact with, have such a full history that is brought to a conversation that you're just like, Diana. Like, seriously, no wonder your books take so long to write and read. Because every single person that comes in is not just, you know, person number B who works at a bar and serves a drink. They all have lived a full life that we all get to glimpse in the course of whatever conversation they may have on that one page in that one chapter. But that's just a testament to her writing. But I'm just like, it's unnecessary, but it's so fulfilling, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
Another thing about Diana's books that make everything feel so real and tangible, because that's how people are. You don't have day players who show up in your life, wave and leave. You know, most people that you sit down and have a conversation with, you walk away knowing a little something about that person, an essence of that person. And she does that every time with all of her little minor or side characters. I just think it's, you know, worth praising.
Jocasta comes in at this point and joins them. Now, remember, in the books, I bring this up because Jocasta comes in and the narrator, so it's a third person, but I think it's through Roger's, from his point of view, it's not first person Roger.
Correct.
He sees Jocasta come in and he mentions something about Ulysses, which made me think, oh, Ulysses. So in the books, Ulysses we haven't done this yet. No, but did he? I'm so confused. He must have because they mention it. Okay. In the books, book five, Ulysses had to go away for a bit after killing Lieutenant Wolf, right? And yes. that's mentioned in this chapter because he's back. From where? We don't know.
Yeah, they don't really say where he had to go. They just say he had to go away.
Exactly. So plot twist, the show had Ulysses kill Forbes and then F off to England with Lord John. So here in the story, though, here in the canon, she'd gotten, or Ulysses came back. Ulysses came back. So I'm not going to talk again. I don't mind. And Summer and I will mention little things like where it's up till now, like that change. It's one thing we will mention a change as it comes up, but we're not going to. Yeah, we're not going to signal things, and we're not going to, you know, like, we're trying to keep to the books as much as possible. And normally, until this book, Thanks. Thank you, stars. Until this book, we didn't have to dance like this. Now we got to dance.
But because we have to dance, but we also have to not talk about it because it will never be discussed again because we didn't get a chance to discuss it before they aired it. So because that alone, it's going to get mentioned. And I will bring it up when there's things that from this book were moved into the previous season. They're going to get talked about because I didn't have the forethought to read ahead to prepare for last season.
No, I know. Ginger, we weren't supposed to.
Of course they didn't. Of course they didn't. And of course we weren't. My point is that the conversation that I would have had it all been contained from the same book, watching the episode is different than the one that we had watching just the episode because I didn't get to talk about the adaptation of that scene. The only thing I knew was for sure it came from the next book. So that's why I'm saying I'm still going to talk about it. We don't harp on adaptation too much and we don't dwell on it, but I'm going to bring it up.
Well, I think until we're caught up. Like I said, and it's probably only going to get, and by worse, I don't mean quality, but worse as in happening more frequently. It's going to happen more frequently. Okay, first of all, and I'm not saying this because I or Summer have any insider knowledge. We absolutely do not. And I'm not saying this because I'm poo-pooing anything, because Summer and I have said, or at least I have said, we pray for all the books. That's not gone away. I'm just stating a fact.
Well, I pray that they don't do all the books in 6 seasons.
Oh, God, no. Don't even put that out into the ether, girl. I still want all the books.
I'm just saying, if they adapt it way too quickly and give us all the books.
Okay. No. That would ruin it in my eyes. Anyway, we still want all the books, you know, at a decent pace. And again, the books just get longer, not shorter. But my point is at this point, they have only greenlit up through season 6. That's it. I'm not saying there won't be more. I'm not saying that. I'm saying they have only greenlit through season 6. So what does that mean? All it means is at this point, there is no season 7 and 8. That's all I'm saying. Because officially.
They are not guaranteed or promised at this point.
So it is almost dinner time. Thomas Christie shows up for dinner and then Archbug. And Roger thinks I can relax a bit. You know, I can relax a bit. Or maybe Arch didn't show up yet because Roger is thinking he's going to relax and he wonders, where was Arch? And then Roger thinks about it. He's like, oh, surely he's gone down to the meadow to tell someone something where all the people are. And that's an interesting, I'm not going to harp on it too much, but remember, just keep it in the very, very, very back of your mind that they're at River Run. Arch is there. He knows for a fact Arch is there. Arch helped him collect the people. And he doesn't see him. So he doesn't think anything bad. He assumes he's somewhere. That's all. Just keep that in the very back of your brain. Roger excuses himself and goes to the house. And Jem is sitting in the kitchen eating bread pudding for dinner. And they share it.
Smart boy.
And then Then Fedra offers to take Jem up to bed. Roger follow her. Roger follows her.
Ginger, what did you just say? Did you say Sergio? Because I swear to God, I heard Sergio.
Excuse me?
And I was
me?
Like, there is no Sergio in this book.
I said, then Phaedra offers to take Jem up to bed.
Yeah, it sounded like Sergio.
No. Roger follows her. And before
he leaves them. I can't see him giving
them,
Sergio his son.
Before Roger leaves them, Phaedra tells him of some happenings. They were in town. They were in a store. Jem was walking around in a store and she was following him. And she saw a tall, blonde, or light haired, she says, green eyed man. And this man sees Jem and stares. And she didn't like the look that he was giving Jem. The man asks Jem who his dad is.
Who's your daddy?
And she answers to the man, Roger McKenzie. And the man answers, is he then, my wee manin? Is he indeed?
Is he now?
Fedra gives this back as she's telling Roger. Roger says she's a natural mimic. And she mimics this man's Irish lilt. You know, first of all, because interested in Jem, you probably had an idea who he was, the tall, blonde, whatever. But the fact that he has Irish lilt is solidifies it. And then the man left. And Fedra...
I like to pretend that Fedra is kind of like that one improv student in college who, like, stops, takes a breath, takes an inhale. And then when they open their eyes, they are that person. Like, she's just doing an improv performance for Roger.
And then Fedra... had not spoken to DaCosta about anything, so they agree to kind of to leave it that way. And he asks, he's about to head back downstairs, and he asks Fedra to stay with Jem until Roger's ready to go up to bed, and she does. And then finally, we are reminded of the existence of the Jacobite gold.
That I just wanted to point out that when I spoke earlier about adaptation, mm-hmm. this was the scene I was speaking of. This was adapted to be used in season
with Roger?
5. And it didn't... not with Roger. That's what I'm saying. It was not with Roger. They took this scene and had it with Sophie. With Brianna. Brianna, and I think it was Mrs. Bug was like, oh, when we were in Cross Creek, we were getting whatever, and this man came over and gave him a quarter.
Yeah.
Or whatever kind of coin he gave him. But that's basically this scene.
Yeah.
The scene that just happened in this book... was what they adapted for the previous season. So we won't be seeing this scene for sure because they've already done it, kind of.
Well, they won't because Bonnet's dead.
Well, that too.
Not that too. That made obviously. That first. But yes,
I already agree. Did it. They're not, I'm just saying, you don't do it again when you've already done it. I mean, yes, and Bonnet is dead.
Bonnet is dead kind of chumps everything. But yes. So
I hate you.
Back to where we were. We're reminded of the Jacobite gold. Bonnet was interested in it. Remember that whole thing that they left out of the... And that is something... Actually, tell me this. Because we know about the Jacobite gold. They covered that. They introduced it. And a little bit of
DaCosta's background.
And how she lost her daughter who was left. And she and Hector came to the colonies with the gold. So we know that that's how River Rome was built. I mean, and we don't know what they're going to do. That could be as far as it goes in the show. We don't know. In the book, if you guys have followed us around, that would be freaky. Please don't. If you've followed us along with us, then you have listened to our discussion, or if you've even just read the book and that's it. That's all introduced as far as DaCosta, as far as the Hector's mausoleum, like the gold is there, like, and, you know, the killing of Dr. Rawling. All this stuff is from book 5. They kept Dr. Rawlings, obviously, in a very different way. But there was no body. And that's fine. Whatever. It's done. But they did not, other than telling us about that the gold existed and then saying that's kind of what they built River Run with, you know, that gives a, okay, that's great. You know, they built River Run. They bought their slaves. But one thing that, and I guess, I was about to say, one thing they didn't do, but again, Bonnet's dead. It doesn't matter. One of the things that they didn't do, and they didn't need to, is that when they decided to kill off Bonnet in season 5, and he was not lasting into season 6, they did not need to do this. Like I said, there's a lot of, I won't say good, but there's a lot of good only in the sense of you save a lot of time. You buy a lot of time for season 6 if you want to do more, because book 6 is like, oh man. It's so full of so much stuff. Put it this way, even without the Battle of Alamance and the hanging, so much stuff from season 5 was taken from season 6. I mean, book 6. It's ridiculous. Claire's abduction, her rape, Brownsville was in book 6, 5. My point is Bonnet's execution. All of that stuff. So it's mind-boggling that even without that, there's still like crap ton left. But I think they've made themselves, I said it multiple times and I'll continue to say it, they have bought themselves a lot of time and space, which they need, because as I said, the books are not getting any longer, and we're not getting any more episodes. Like 11 is what we have now, and we'll be lucky to keep that. I think season 6 is 11 as well. But again, going forward, if there are more seasons, hopefully they don't go down anymore. Anyway, so we're reminded of the Jacobite gold. And the reason I bring this next part up is because if this is your first time reading book 6 and you have watched season 5, it might be a little funky. So we're not going to spoil like all the twists and turns in the book, because that's why we're doing the read along. But in book five, if you have read that as well, you know that Bonnet appeared in the middle behind, behind Jamie when he walked in on Claire doing that on the slave autopsy. So, and what was Bonnet there for? He was there for the gold. Okay. Bonnet was there for the gold. It was interesting. He knew about it. He didn't know where it was, but he knew about it. And he was pretty sure that he was getting warm, like there around. And he was. It was getting quite hot, actually, there around River Run. But he never found it. So in the series, they completely took that away. As far, not only is Bonnet dead, yes, but there was no interest in gold. And even if there were, it doesn't matter now because he's dead. But since he's not dead in the story, in the books, we're going to go along with that. So Bonnet knew about it. And so this makes him think not only of the danger to Jem, right, and the man who had raped his wife, but also he remembers, this reminds him of the Jacobite gold in Hector Cosm's, I can't even talk today, in Hector Cameron's mausoleum, where it's hidden. Bonnet suspected it was somewhere at River Run, as I said, and he was tempted, Roger was tempted, to stay behind and let the others take the new settlers to the ridge. What do we call it? I said ridge dwellers?
The ridge dwellers.
No, but what did you call them? Goblins?
The goblins.
Okay. So Roger was very tempted to stay behind. He probably would have left Jem with at River Run. But he was tempted to stay behind and let the goblins go to the ridge, be taken to the ridge, so he could stay back and hunt Bonnet. But he knew that he had been tasked with something very important, to be there and help be a bridge between the goblins and the papists. I think that's the title, Goblins and Papists. So he would, though, have to tell Duncan, meaning he would have to tell Duncan about Bonnet. And Lorraine B. closes us out with, it's what I was alluding to, but I didn't say directly. I think I hit on it by saying all the stuff that we got in this chapter. And Summer did say it much more directly. Lorraine B. says, it's chapters like this that keep me up late into the night wanting more. It's been a while since I've read this book. And as I've discovered time and again with the series, there's so much in it. A second, third, or fourth read is just like reading it for the first time.
I mean, especially if you're doing a read through from start to finish, because there's so many books.
Yes.
That by the time you get to 8.
Oh, my.
It's like you've never read that book before.
And that we have completed part 2. We're moving on to part 3, entitled To Everything There Is a Season. And we will be discussing chapter 16, entitled, Ginger, I'm going to give this one to you because it's in French.
Le mot juste.
Yeah, that's not what I would have said.
What would you have said?
Le mot juste.
Okay.
Chapter 17, The Limits of Power, and chapter 18, entitled, this one I can definitely read, Vroom.
Aww. I got a little tear prick, you guys. If you've read it, you know, Summer, okay, you've only read it once, but you know what a vroom is, right? You remember that.
I do.
Don't say what it is, but you remember,
I
right?
I do. I won't. I will say nothing. But, no, I don't.
Oh, honestly, okay.
I have ideas of what I think it could be. Because, yes, I have read this, and I know the characters pretty well at this point.
Okay.
So I feel like I can figure out kind of what it's about. But that being said, it's been a while, y'all. It's been a while. So I am excited to read it for the first time all over again.
Huh. For the second time.
And if for the second time. And of course, if you'd like to continue the conversation, you can join us at our Facebook group at www.outlanderpod.com/group.
Check out our shop. We've got t-shirts with our art and face masks and loads of things. Go to outlanderpod.com/shop. And again, a final thank you to our co-producer for this episode, Laura D. A co-producer is someone who supports us on Patreon. You can find out more at patreon.com/outlanderpod. And they get all the benefits, bonuses
of lower tiers, which is the, we have three tiers, a $1, a $5, and a $10 a month. And our co-producers are those who support us at $10 a month. And they get the ad-free episodes. They get our annual Beltane Blessings card, which is one time a year where we can send everything out, send a card to everyone, and we sign everyone. And just our way of saying thank you. And of course, anything we post in there, you guys would get as well. But to find out more, as I said, you can go to www.patreon.com/outlanderpod. And thank you, as always, so much for listening. We look forward to our next episode. Thank you to our generous partner, Zencastr, who offers high-fidelity podcasting. Check out Zencastr and use coupon code OUTLANDER20, OUTLANDER20, for 20% off 3 months or 20% off for a year. Connect with us. Visit our website at outlanderpod.com. Find us on Facebook, facebook.com/outlanderpod. We'd love for you to join our Facebook community at outlanderpod.com/group. Follow us on Twitter and Instagram at outlanderpod.